The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, the phoner book is okay. The other one's a lot better. Just if you're going to the book room. So this talk will be based on the book. The book is a collection of primary documents. It's a reader in the history of early American socialism and its approach to the race question. Early socialists, like socialists today, write a lot. The talk itself is only going to cover a fairly small portion of what's actually in the book, and there's going to be there's a lot of interesting stuff that I'm just not going to have time to get into. If there's stuff that you've heard of that you want to talk about in discussion, we can talk about it there. But this talk is going to be somewhat compressed because it's a lot of history, even though it's only covering the period from 1900 to 1930. So in 1913, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great black Marxist historian, sociologist, and many other titles as well, wrote that racism is, quote, the great test of the American socialist. And subsequent decades, or subsequent generations of the left have tended to agree with this judgment and have seen the question of racism and the question of opposition to racism, the question of black liberation, as one of the key tasks of the American left, and have seen the American left's position and actions on this subject as one of the key deciding marks of whether the left can move forward or not. That's something that has been woven very deeply into the fiber of the American left. And so from communists going into Alabama in the 1930s to organize black workers and black sharecroppers and to fight against Klan terror to the 1960s when socialists were at the very center, socialists like Bayard Rustin, for example, with the very center of organizing the civil rights movement, to the Movement for Black Lives platform, that came out a few years ago, that has a very radical vision of opposing exploitation and opposing racism. The left has been intimately involved with anti-racist struggles in the United States for most of the last century. For most of the last century, the left has taken very seriously the question of whether it will pass Du Bois' test. And in the U.S., there's a tendency to kind of treat that as kind of natural, like, oh, if you're on the left, obviously you're anti-racist. Like, that's not really a question. But it's worth saying that that's not really necessarily the case everywhere. So if you go to, like, France, for example, where every other street is named after Mumia Abu-Jamal because there's, like, communist mayors and there's a real, you know, communist presence in government and things like that. So Mumia Abu-Jamal's, you know, name is everywhere. And yet, the same leftists who are naming streets after Mumia Abu-Jamal are often think like, that, for example, that the concept of state racism, that like the state is racist, which in America is like, duh, you know, like the Constitution kind of said so pretty explicitly. In France, there's huge controversy on the left over the question of state racism, as it's called, right? So it's not the case that the development of a strong left inevitably means a real commitment to fighting racism. And so how that came to be in the United States, how anti-racism and the left in the United States came to be so intimately connected is actually a history that needs to be told. It's not something that we can just assume. There's a standard answer to this question, which goes like this. For a long time, referring mostly to the Socialist Party, which was the main expression of the American left from 1900 to 1920, the American left was either basically racist, or at the very best, class reductionist, right? Extremely class reductionist, that said, there's one struggle, that's the class struggle, and anything else is a distraction from that. And then in 1929, the Communist Party had the Black Belt thesis handed down. If you don't know what that is, don't worry, I'll get into that a little bit later, but this is just kind of the capsule history. The Black Belt thesis comes down from the Comintern in Russia, and that says the left in the U.S. has to take racism seriously and has to fight racism. And that's where we get all the incredible history of, like, yeah, the Communist Party in the 1930s, the fight for justice for the Scottsboro Boys, the Communist City Councilman in New York, Ben Davis, the Black City Councilman, who was an incredible voice against racism. The history of communist struggles and socialist struggles against racism in the 30s and 40s that we look to as so inspiring, people often trace that back to the Black Belt thesis. And what my book is kind of all about arguing is that's all wrong. that actually the commitment of American socialists to the project of black liberation goes back much earlier than the Black Belt thesis, and that there's an entire generation of black and white socialists alike who argued in the face of, you know, opposition from white supremacist terrorism and racism in our society more generally, and also opposition from some of their own comrades, that that the project of black liberation had to be a central one for the American left. And so this book is about reconstructing that history and that debate, and seeing how that actually forms these very deep roots for the contemporary commitment on the American left to anti-racism. And so in this talk, I want to go through kind of the highlights of and some of the lowlights as well of this history. So, you know, if you've really done any reading at all about the question of race and leftism in the United States, you've probably come across a Eugene Debs quote from 1903 that's often used to summarize the kind of stance of the Socialist Party on race. And the quote is that we have nothing special to offer the Negro. That's the quote, and that's from this Debs article. But I want to give the whole quote here. It's from a medium-length article that's very interesting in a lot of ways. And this quote comes at the very end of the article. It's in one of the last paragraphs. So the last two or three paragraphs go, In closing, permit me to express the hope that the next convention may repeal the resolutions on the Negro question. The Negro does not need them, and they serve to increase rather than diminish the necessity for explanation. We have nothing special to offer the Negro, and we cannot make separate appeals to all the races. The Socialist Party is the party of the working class, regardless of color, the whole working class of the whole world. Now, this is certainly not Debs at his best. Debs was, you know, a fantastic writer who could write movingly about the oppression that workers in the United States faced and the possibilities of resistance to that oppression. These lines are not him at his best. And yet, when you read these, you say, okay, he says the hope that the next convention may repeal the resolutions on the Negro question. Well, what's the resolution on the Negro question then? He's referring to a resolution that passed at the founding convention of the Socialist Party 2 years earlier. And I'll read the resolution. It's a little bit long, but it's worth going through the whole thing. So, the Negro Resolution. Whereas, the Negroes of the United States, because of their long training in slavery and but recent emancipation therefrom, occupy a peculiar position in the working class and in society at large. Whereas, the capitalist class seeks to preserve this peculiar condition and to foster and increase color prejudice and race hatred between the white worker and the black, so as to make their social and economic interests appear to be separate and antagonistic, in order that the workers of both races may thereby be more easily and completely exploited. Whereas, both the old political parties and educational and religious institutions alike betray the Negro in his present helpless struggle against disenfranchisement and violence in order to receive the economic favors of the capitalist class, be it therefore resolved that we, the Socialists of America, in National Convention assembled, do hereby assure our Negro fellow worker of our sympathy with him in his subjection to lawlessness and oppression, and also assure him of the fellowship of the workers who suffer from the lawlessness and exploitation of capital in every nation or tribe of the world. Be it further resolved that we declare to the Negro worker the identity of his interests and struggles with the interests and struggles of the workers of all lands, without regard to race or color or sectional lines, that the causes which have made him the victim of social and political inequality are the effects of the long exploitation of his labor power, that all social and racial prejudices spring from the ancient economic causes which still endure, to the misery of the whole human family, that the only line of division which exists in fact between the producer, is that between the producers and owners of the world, between capitalism and labor. And be it further resolved that we, the American Socialist Party, invite the Negro to membership and fellowship with us in the world movement for economic emancipation, by which equal liberty and opportunity shall be secured to every man, and fraternity become the order of the world. So this is a pretty good resolution, particularly when you consider it was written in 1901 at a convention of overwhelmingly white socialists. So this is something actually fairly unique in American life at this point, that an overwhelmingly white organization passes a resolution inviting black Americans to join and assuring them of their sympathy for their struggle against racism. Now, it was fought for at the convention. It was not uncontroversial at the convention at which it was passed. So it was fought for by black and white delegates alike. And originally, there were three black delegates at the conference. Originally, two of the black delegates basically agreed with Debs's position that kind of a special appeal to black workers was unnecessary. We could just appeal to all workers. But once the resolution was introduced, and some socialists said things like, this resolution might make a great deal of trouble in the South. The black delegates who had initially opposed it began supporting it and adding amendments to it to strengthen it, to throw in references to lynching, to disenfranchisement, to all of the forms of black oppression at the time. And eventually, it was passed with overwhelming support from white and the black socialists alike. So this should complicate the idea that the Socialist Party ignored race. The quote that is most often used to demonstrate that the Socialist Party ignored race was Debs responding to the Socialist Party not ignoring race, right? Like, the quote comes up because of a resolution that was not ignoring race. So that should kind of clue us in that the story is more complicated and that nothing special to offer the Negro can't be an accurate summation of the Socialist Party's record in these years. If you go back to the essay, which you can find it on, it's in the book, that's the first place you should find it. If you come up afterwards, I can tell you other places to find it, but for now we'll just say it's in the book. In the same essay, if you go up just a few paragraphs, Debs is saying, "Socialists should with pride proclaim their sympathy with and fealty to the black race, and if there be any who hesitate to avow themselves in the face of ignorant and unreasonable prejudice, they lack the true spirit of the slavery-destroying revolutionary movement." That was how Debs thought of socialism, the slavery-destroying revolutionary movement. That's a vision that's profoundly informed by the struggles of the Civil War a generation before him, right? And it's clearly nothing special to offer the Negro doesn't capture everything that even Debs himself is thinking at this time, let alone the party more broadly. And though Debs was one of the best on this in these early years, that quote, I love that quote, the spirit of the slavery destroying revolutionary movement, was one Debs was at the highest level of the party in these years. But he was by no means alone in assigning a great deal of importance to the question of black liberation in the United States. And in fact, as Philip Foner has written, the race question was actually the question that was most discussed in the party behind the farmer question. You know, this time, obviously, American farmers are being proletarianized and stuff. That was a major source of debate in the party. But behind that, it was the race question was the next one. And yet and still, you can read history books written in the last 10 years that say, the Socialist Party didn't really discuss race. The Socialist Party had no discussion of race. It's a complete fiction, and the record of it is there to see in all the Socialist Party publications. Now, to say that the race question was one of the most debated questions in the party is unfortunately not to say that all of that debate was good. A great deal of it was bad, and in fact, the Socialist Party gave voice to the racism that existed throughout American society at that time. So Julius Wayland, who was the publisher of The Appeal to Reason, the great Socialist Party newspaper that had, a massive subscription base, hundreds of thousands throughout the country, Julius Wayland thought that socialism would be a segregated society, for example. He thought that socialism meant segregation. A leading figure in the party in many ways. If you read the International Socialist Review of the time, which became one of the theoretical journal of the left wing of the party, in the early issues you can find debates about race science, for example, debates about, kind of craniometry kind of stuff, who's got the bigger skull, and those are the kind of great advances in science. And in the southern states, the state parties often accepted segregation. They often set up segregated locals, wouldn't have segregated meetings, things like that. So it's not the case that the party as a whole rejected full-scale the racism of American society. And that, again, just kind of underlines the point I made earlier that how the American left came to accept anti-racism as one of its central orienting points is something that has to be explained. Because in the early 1900s, that wasn't the case. At the same time that there was this tremendous racism in the party, the party gave voice to the racism that was found throughout American society, it also contained some of the forces that were most opposed to that racism and did some of the most important work in opposing it. So in Oklahoma, which was the state in which the Socialist Party actually had the highest per capita membership, there were more members in New York, but because Oklahoma had such a small population, in terms of density, Oklahoma was the top state. Oklahoma was also a state in which disenfranchisement and Jim Crow laws came later than in a lot of the rest of the South. And the party in around 1910 led, for years, led a whole series of campaigns against these laws that were incredibly important. So that, you know, there was a disenfranchisement law that passed that the party collected, that the party attempted to run a referendum against opposing it, and they lost the referendum, although they did a tremendous amount of work collecting signatures, things like that, and actually gained the support of black newspapers in Oklahoma in the process, because they were the only party that was really opposing this referendum. But they lose the referendum. Then, however, it's Socialist Party lawyers who are suing this law, saying it's unconstitutional, and they actually get it overturned. And a few years later, the state passes a literacy test, you know, which again, you know, these kind of literacy tests are given and administered in a way that's very unequal for black and white takers of the test. And the party leads a referendum campaign against this, and at one point is collecting 2,000 signatures a day for this. They're really hitting the pavement on behalf of fighting against this literacy law that's mainly about disenfranchising black voters. So in Oklahoma, in a party that was, again, overwhelmingly white, the party is leading a struggle against disenfranchisement. And if you read, like, black newspapers in Oklahoma at the time, the Oklahoma black newspapers are like, wow, these socialists seem like the real deal. Like, they're really throwing themselves into this. Okay, great. Thank you. Also, in 1908, after the Springfield race riot in Springfield, Illinois, which is a very horrible race riot, pogrom, which a large part of the black population of the town is kicked out of town, basically just run out of town and made homeless. William English Walling is a Socialist Party member who's covering that, who's a journalist and is writing about it, and is publicizing the horror of the race riot. And eventually he and Mary White Ovington, who's another Socialist Party member, help begin the founding of the NAACP together. And they get together eventually with DuBois and a number of other figures to found the NAACP. So at the same time that the party contains the racism of American society, it also contains some of the most advanced elements in fighting it. And in these years also, black socialists begin to have an impact. So the most important kind of early black socialist is George Washington Woodbey, who was a black socialist preacher on the West Coast, who was born a slave in 1854 in Tennessee, and in the late kind of 19th century goes through a whole series of the reform movements that were sweeping American society. Populism, progressivism, all these kinds of different movements. He joins the Socialist Party in 1902 and quickly becomes one of the most popular speakers on the entire West Coast. And if you know anything about kind of the history of California and radicalism in the early 20th century, you know that California was extraordinarily repressive. You know, LA was a company town, basically, in these years. And there were explosive free speech fights over the simple right to assemble in public throughout these years. And Woodbey was one of the most important leaders of these fights. And he was arrested, beaten by cops again and again. I mean, it'd be the kind of thing where, like, the he would be giving a talk and the cops would come and shut it down with their billy clubs. You know, they'd just beat people. And then Woodbey would regroup the crowd and lead a march on the police station to protest the shutting down. That took a lot. that guy had courage. When an LA hotel wouldn't let him stay there because he was black, he organized the entire city of LA, the whole Socialist Party branch in the city, to boycott that hotel and to issue a resolution saying workers should no longer stay at this hotel. This hotel draws the color line. Woodbey was an incredibly dynamic organizer and speaker, one of the real leaders on the West Coast. And he argued that there was a natural alliance between the Socialist Party and black Americans. And his case was very simple. He said, look, black Americans are overwhelmingly workers. This is a working class race. Socialist Party is the party of workers. Black Americans belong in the Socialist Party. And he had a lot of interesting things to say about that, about talking about the police, the evolution of the police from slave catchers, that kind of thing. And I had some really interesting writings on socialism and religion, arguing that because of the importance of the black church in America, that the Socialist Party couldn't take on the kind of position that, like, we're an atheist party that's against religion, that kind of thing. So he was thinking very hard about how to unite the Socialist Party and black Americans, and how this, you know, what seemed like this natural alliance could be brought into reality. Importantly, he was also a very strong foe of anti-immigrant racism, which on the West Coast permeated the left, from the IWW and the left wing of the Socialist Party to the right wing kind of sewer socialists. On the West Coast, xenophobia and anti-Chinese racism in particular were absolutely virulent, and Woodby stood strong against that. Was one basically the only prominent West Coast socialist to do so on a consistent basis. There was also Hubert Henry Harrison, who kind of came slightly after Woodby, who was the most important Black Socialist Party activist in this period, an immigrant from the Caribbean who came to the United States and worked as in the post office, working his way through school, and actually lost his job in the post office because of Booker T. Washington, the Black leader at the time. His political machine took notice of Harrison when Harrison wrote a letter to the newspaper criticizing Washington's conciliation with white supremacy. You can find the letters in the archive of Washington and his lieutenant gloating over getting Harrison fired for this. And getting a job in the post office at this time for a Black immigrant would have been one of the very best jobs he could have had. So this is a really serious attack on his livelihood. I mean, you get to see kind of some of the class divisions in strategies in Black America at the time in that. Harrison joins the Socialist Party not long after that episode and quickly establishes himself as one of the leading street speakers in New York. And this was a time when, like, street speaking, speaking on a soapbox was an art, right? And in which it was really competitive. Like, if you weren't good at it, you were going to get heckled down really quickly. It's not like people would just walk by and ignore you. No, people would heckle you and get you off the stage because there were people out doing it who were really good and they wanted to hear them. Well, Harrison was the best of these. And people like Henry Adams, who wrote like Tropic of Cancer, wrote about how awesome, he's kind of just random novelist, but grew up in New York, wrote about how Harrison was his idol because he was just such an incredible speaker. Harrison affiliates to the left wing of the Socialist Party and is a supporter of the IWW, militant unionism, all of that kind of stuff. And unfortunately gets caught up in the factionalism around this in 1912 and is basically pushed out of the party for being a supporter of the left at the same time that Big Bill Haywood, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World leader, is pushed out of the party as well. And Harrison is pushed out. Before he goes, he writes a series of pieces in the Socialist press arguing that the Socialist Party has to make a choice between Southernism or Socialism, and that the two things can't coexist in one party. So now, even though Harrison is pushed out and Woodby kind of fades from the historical record by about 1915, it's not kind of clear what happens in his later life. They made real progress. Figures like them and their allies like Mary White Ovington and William English Walling made real progress in pushing the Socialist Party to take organizing Black workers more seriously. After 1910, the Socialist Party forms a student chapter at Howard University, for example. The West Virginia Party, which is again overwhelmingly white, it starts to make declarations of interracial solidarity, things like that. There's signs that the party is moving. But all of this is cut short by the crisis that's provoked by World War I and the repression that comes with it. So when World War I breaks out, the vigilante violence and state repression that's directed against the Socialist Party is absolutely immense. So in Oklahoma, for example, the party actually dissolves itself to avoid state repression after an abortive rebellion. The party just dissolves itself. So the state section of the party that had the best role in fighting anti-racism just disappears under the impact of state repression. Additionally, the Socialist Party undergoes a devastating split in which its kind of more conservative leadership ends up expelling the majority of the party for their radicalism and in particular for their support of the Russian Revolution and their desire to see a revolution in the United States. And that split absolutely cripples the Socialist Party and by 1920 it is no longer the leading organization of American radicalism, and for the next generation it would remain basically eclipsed by the Communist Party as the leading voice of the American left. Nonetheless, even in the midst of this period in which the Socialist Party is falling apart, there's very exciting developments going on the subject of the left and race. And in particular, there's two journals founded by young Black radicals that kind of chart a path forward, even in spite of the wreckage that World War I is bringing. So the Messenger is founded in 1917 by A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen, who are two migrants to New York City from the South, young socialists, extremely militant, anti-World War I, pro-Bolshevik. They actually, at one point, they join the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party sends them on a speaking tour against World War I, and they get arrested in, like, Ohio for speaking against the war. And when they're before the judge ends up saying, I don't believe, because they're like 19 or 20 at the time. The judge is like, I don't believe these young kids could have made these speeches. Like, someone put them up to this. And, you know, Randolph and Owen are sitting up there like, yeah, we don't know who told us to do this. You know, like, that guy, someone just gave us this stuff. I don't know. And they get let go because of that. They're able to use the judge's racism to get out of the prosecution for once. But they're absolutely militant opponents of World War I and supporters of the Russian Revolution. They're tracking the Russian Revolution even before the Bolsheviks come to power. In the Messenger's very first issue, they're writing, the Russian Revolution is going on and it's going to continue until all privilege in the world is extinguished. Long live the socialist government of Kerensky. and then in the next issue, they say, long live Lenin and Trotsky. But there's no kind of addendum of like, they kind of let that fade. But the paper circulates widely. So sometimes if you read histories, there's like, this was just like white socialists were buying this things. But historians that have been more careful and actually track this kind of stuff find that it circulated widely among the black working class. So like there were black soldiers imprisoned at Fort Leavenworth after a rebellion on a base against racism. They were reading the Messenger. Black dock workers in Philadelphia who were organizing in IWW locals, interracial militant locals to fight the bosses on the dock. They were reading the Messenger, right? It was circulating very widely throughout the black working class. And people who study the black press at this time say that, like, you have to understand that for every copy of a paper that was sold, it was probably going to be read by five different people, right? It was going to be passed around from hand to hand. And the Messenger had a circulation of, 10, 20,000. So there were lots and lots of people reading the Messenger. Now, the Messenger, despite the fact that they are dedicated opponents of racism in the labor movement, absolute critics of the AFL and the AFL's accommodation to racism, they stay with the center of the Socialist Party. They don't go with the left when the left is kicked out of the Socialist Party. And in the early 1920s, they move to the right. And what's interesting about this is in a lot of the discussion of this, it's said that like A. Philip Randolph and Owen and the Messenger kind of moved from class first to race first, right? They moved to focusing on class to focusing on race. But actually, if you go back and read it, what you find is that when they moderate their class radicalism, when they say, you know, like what happened in Russia might be good for Russia, but that's not good here anymore. You know, the Socialist Party that's way more moderate now is the way we have to go. They also begin moderating their race radicalism. So they begin saying that like the AFL, like the fact that the AFL excludes black workers is like, they're like, well, you know, the labor movement has its divisions in every country. Right? So it's not the case that they move from class radicalism to race radicalism. When they retreat from class radicalism, they retreat from race radicalism at the same time, right? They begin making excuses for the AFL bureaucracy that they had earlier, 5 years earlier, been so clear on just how disastrous that racism was. I have 10 minutes left? 8? Okay. 10, 8, no, what's the difference? So the other crucial magazine is The Crusader, founded by Cyril Briggs, who's another Caribbean immigrant like Hubert Harrison. And he founds The Crusader as this kind of journal of like black nationalism and socialism at the same time. And what's interesting is at the same time that like Briggs is a resolute black nationalist who, you know, at times writes like, you know, the course of history is determined by these like primordial races competing with one another, like very, you know, deep kind of metaphysical black nationalism. He's also very sympathetic to the Socialist Party. And when he sees like the socialists being repressed by the state is like, well, their enemy is clearly our enemy. Like we should be allies. So for him, again, it's like the socialists, the fact that he was a black nationalist didn't lead him to see the Socialist Party as like this like class reductionist thing he shouldn't be engaging with. And he actually starts reading Marx and like he's quoting like Value, Price, and Profit in the newspaper. And, I mean, he has a really interesting mix of ideology. I'm not going to be able to get into it, I think, for time reasons. But, you know, he forms the African Blood Brotherhood, which is this secret society that's devoted to, like, black self-defense against lynching, against white supremacist violence, all of that kind of stuff. And this then becomes the foundation for the early black cadres of the Communist Party, because Briggs and most of the ABB leadership is recruited to the CP in 1921. So Briggs kind of moves away from the more extreme black nationalism of the, that you see in the early Crusader. And him and people like Richard B. Moore and their comrades become the early black cadres of the party that have some serious politics and some serious weight with black workers who read the journal. So they kind of provide the party when they're recruited in 21 with its first inroads into black working class communities. So that brings us to the Communist Party more generally. So when the Socialist Party splits, the left wing goes on to found not one, but two Communist Parties, because two is better than one, the Communist Labor Party and the Communist Party of America. And both of them are pretty bad on the race question initially. Both of them, neither of them pays much attention to it in their like founding documents. They give it at most perfunctory attention. But even worse, the Communist Party of America is based in Chicago, and they're founded right like during the race riots of Red Summer in Chicago. And the article that they write on this is like, these wage workers are so stupid fighting each other when they should be fighting the bosses, right? They treat like race riots as if they're a distraction from the class struggle. It's very, very bad. And so for the first, you know, two years or so of the existence of these two communist parties, they basically achieved nothing on race or anything else for that matter. In 1921, though, there manages to be some unity between the parties, and there's a merger brought on at kind of Comintern urging, largely. And in 1922 is when things really begin to change at the Fourth Congress of the Communist International. And what's key here is that Claude McKay, who is a black Jamaican poet who was living in the United States, had lived in England, and became a socialist, and is at the center of these kind of black radical circles in New York. He manages to secure an invitation to the Communist International, to the Congress, and goes and gives a speech on racism in the United States, in which he's saying that the Communist parties have not given the race question the attention it deserves, that it's a crucial question in America, and he expands that actually to a short book that he writes in Russia. And McKay's speech influences the theses on the Negro question, which are then issued, which are included in the book. The theses on the Negro question really lay the basis for the approach to anti-racism that comes later. And they're really interesting to read, because what they're written in the context of the Comintern considering, you know, the entire world situation. And what they're saying is there needs to be an alliance of black Americans and Africans against colonialism and against racism worldwide. That's the kind of vision that that the theses are laying out. And they also say, there's a line that says this: "The Communist International notes with satisfaction the resistance of the exploited Negro to the exploiter's attack. For the enemy of his race and the enemy of the white workers are one and the same, capitalism and imperialism." And what's interesting about this is if you go back to the Negro Resolution from the Socialist Party, again in the book, what you notice about it is it talks about the exploitation that black Americans face, but there's nothing in it about the resistance that black Americans have mounted against that exploitation and oppression, right? The theses on the Negro question for the first time treat black resistance as a political fact that the communist movement needs to take account of, as well as black oppression, and that's a real step forward. That's a massive step forward for the American left. Now, what comes out of this is that Robert Minor, who's a Texan, who is a cartoonist and a syndicalist and then joins the Communist Party, takes over race work for the party. And it says something that the party, at this point, still didn't put a black communist in charge of race work. But of the white communists that they did put in charge, Robert Minor was definitely the best. And he writes a whole series of essays going through the history of black resistance to oppression in the United States. Like, you read these essays from 1924, and there's a deeper history of slave rebellions in them than you'll get anywhere, even like today. You know, he talks about Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, the big ones. He also talks about like the German Coast Uprising in Louisiana. He talks about this hidden history of rebellion and says this is the political fact that we need to take account of in thinking about how to relate to the struggle against black oppression, how that struggle is going to be conducted. The fact of an unbroken line of black resistance to oppression. So Minor takes over race work, and in 1925, the party founds the American Negro Labor Congress, which is the an attempt to create like a trade union body for black workers to compete with the racist AFL. And they put Lovett Fort Whiteman, a black Texan, in charge of the ANLC. And Fort Whiteman is an interesting figure who spent time in Russia studying. Not necessarily a gifted organizer. He was known for like walking around Chicago in like full Russian getup after coming back from like the Lenin School. And at the founding Congress of the ANLC, where they're trying to like attract black trade unionists for entertainment that night, he brings a Russian ballet, you know, which is like not, again, not the, he's very big on Russia at the time. And doesn't have a lot of success in the ANLC. And other black communists like Cyril Briggs and like James Ford, who was recruited through the ANLC, are critical of this and say, look, we have to devote more attention to this. This isn't going anywhere. There's clearly so much work to be done in organizing black workers, and this vehicle is not it. Now, they kind of get their wish in 1928, 1929 with the development of the Black Belt Thesis. And what the Black Belt Thesis was a thesis that came down from the Communist International, again, like the theses on the Negro question from 22. And what it said was that in the south of the United States, in the former slave counties, the former majority slave counties, black Americans constituted an oppressed nation with the right to self-determination, and that should be the focus of the communist movement, is on that kind of right to self-determination, right to secession, if they so choose, that kind of thing. And it's true that this did have the effect of orienting the party on anti-racist struggle. Yet, the Black Belt Thesis was actually opposed by people like James Ford and Otto Hall, who were some of the most important early black communists. It came down and was successful because it had the support of the Stalinists in the Comintern. At this time, the Comintern had been thoroughly Stalinized and was completely undemocratic. All decisions happened behind closed doors, and then the kind of meetings were just about, you know, kind of ratifying the decisions that had already been undertaken, that had already been made by the leadership of the Comintern. And so the Black Belt Thesis comes down, and I just think it's a kind of a perverse irony of history that the Black Belt Thesis so often gets the credit for focusing the Communist Party on anti-racism, when black communists like Ford and Hall had been arguing for orienting that and had opposed the Black Belt Thesis, right? And at the same time, the Black Belt Thesis was so distant from the actual struggles and aspirations of black Americans in the South that the party kind of quickly shelved it as a matter of actual propaganda and that kind of thing. And it was, you know, they conducted their actual work, like with the Scottsboro Boys, much more on the basis of the 1922 theses than the Black Belt theses in terms of the theoretical foundation. So to wrap up, which I've been told I need to do, the 1930s, the Scottsboro campaign, all of the fights of you know that you read about in books like Hammer and Hoe or Communists in Harlem and the Depression, that didn't come from nowhere, right? That didn't just magically happen in 28, 29. That was building on a tradition of anti-racist Marxism that black and white communists and socialists alike had been building for three decades in the United States, and was building on the work that goes back to Marx as well. So we have a long tradition of thinking about race, and the way we think about race today needs to build on that tradition, I think. And I'll just say kind of one thing about that. Today, racism is a primary force in radicalizing people in American society, black and white alike, right? I don't think it's an exaggeration to say probably more young white radicals are radicalized by racism than class exploitation in the United States, because racism in the U.S. is so naked, so visible, and so obvious. You know, I don't think there's any danger of the U.S. left, the U.S. socialist left, going in a kind of class reductionist direction, that kind of thing. To the extent that sections of the left do that, they're just going to cut themselves off from the radicalizations that actually happen. It's not going to be a main tendency of the American left. Yet I think, and that's something we should be proud of, and that this tradition is partially responsible for, that centrality of anti-racism to radicalism in the United States. I think it's worth noting, though, that confronting racism today means something very different from confronting racism in the 1930s, for example, in the South. Fighting racism in the South in the 1930s was fighting a social system that was different from the social system in the rest of the United States. This kind of Jim Crow system of agriculture, of exploited black agricultural labor, right? That was going in a different direction from the rest of the country. Obviously, not in terms of racism. There was racism everywhere, but it was a social system that wasn't the main power basis of the ruling class of the entire country. Fighting racism today in America means taking on the ruling class in a completely headfirst way. So fighting racism in Chicago, for example, you can't fight racism in Chicago without taking on housing developers, right? Without taking on the real estate industry. That's the most powerful block in the city politically, you know? So confronting racism today is going to take different strategies and different tactics from what it did previously. And, you know, we've thought a lot about that in the ISO. We have some things to say about that. We also have some more thinking to do about that. But I think that fact that racism today is reproduced through the market directly, right? There's not extra laws saying you can't vote, right? I mean, sometimes they put those laws in, right? It's the market itself that's doing it. It's the main blocks of capital, the main power blocks of capital in American cities that are reproducing racial exploitation. And that means that this heritage of thinking about how you combine the struggle against racial domination, racial oppression, with the struggle against capitalism as a whole is going to be even more vital for advancing that struggle today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.